Well, we may have a little bit of repeating. I know that Stan read the first verse I intend to read right now in the 9 o'clock hour, so that's all right. We just got our brains prepared to start early. So would somebody please turn over to Matthew 5. Matthew 5, and our topic today is salt and light. Matthew 5, verses 13 through 16. Who's got that?
You're the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It is then good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. You are the light of the world. A city is set on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor do they light a lamp and put it under the basket, but on the lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven.
All right, so we are talking about our influence as disciples, our influence on each other, our influence on the world, the influence we're supposed to have and might not have, or how we can improve our influence. And the two metaphors that are used here are salt and light. One of the things it says at the beginning there is, if the salt loses its flavor, how can salt lose its flavor? It's old. So what happens to it? How does oldness make it lose its flavor? There are basically two things that make salt lose its flavor. One is that there just isn't really salt. And what I mean by that is that they didn't have nice, white, crystallized salt, you know, on shakers on their tables back then, right? They were getting salt out of nature, and they were pretty well... two different ways you got it. You either got it out of deposits that were like just salt. Salt's a rock, right? It was just out in the world with other rocks. And so you didn't necessarily have it clean. It was just mixed with other rocks. Or you just had a rock that had a bunch of salt in it. And if you shave some of that off, or if you put it in water or rinse water over it or whatnot, some of the salt would come off. And then you were left eventually where there was no salt. You just had a rock that wasn't salt, and then what good is that? That's not good for anything. And so they'd cast out in the road, and basically it helped be their gravel roads. You didn't want to throw it into your field, because even though it was hard to get anything salty out of it, like you're going to get more dirt flavor than salt flavor out of it at that point, it still did have salt in it. And so if you just like ground it up and put it in your garden, your plants weren't going to live very well, because they're going to be hurt by that. The other way by aging is that it actually is corrupted in some way. It's chemically changed in some way. Well, there's different ways of it happening, but you know, whatever. It's exposed to oxidation, it can be, or the things that are next to it oxidize, and it ends up just getting corrupted with other flavors. This isn't hard for us to understand if you've ever had much anything in your fridge for very long, and it starts taking on the flavors of the other things that are in the fridge. And then it's like, well, do I want to use this salt? Well, no, because this salt is whatever, pickle flavored, or you know, it has the flavor of my leftover pizza from whatever in the world. This is not going to be good to use in something else at that point. So I did not turn my slide. I didn't even start my slides. My goodness, Justin. Come on now. So, disciples are to have a positive influence on the world. The idea here is that it's meant to be impactful. Oh, I didn't mention that. Whew. Maybe I'm going to be ADD today. Y'all better be ready for it. The other place they got salt was places like the Dead Sea. It was just a horribly convenient place to get salt in that part of the world in particular. And that salt was, it was white in most cases, because you were getting a more pure form of salt. And it's, I don't know if you've ever seen pictures of the Dead Sea, but it's truly weird looking. Like, they're just like patties of salt, or in some case, stalagmites of salt that just kind of grow up out of the water. But that was another place they would get it. But that was another case in which that salt was generally thought less of because of how it formed. It had taken on flavors of the environment around it. And the example I would use is, you can imagine if it had a swampy flavor or something like that, how you wouldn't like that salt as well. Now, that's not how the Dead Sea works. The Dead Sea is not a swampy place. Stuff doesn't grow at the Dead Sea. That's how it got the name. But it's taking on those other flavors of the environment there that make it less desirable. Okay, so we are to be a positive influence on the world. In general, salt is a positive influence on the world. There are a lot of things that salt is used for that allows people to accomplish things they couldn't otherwise. One of those is as a preservative. We still do that today. It's still the most common preservative on the earth. There are, of course, other ways that we preserve things with chemicals other than salt, or we preserve them by smoking them, or we preserve them in different ways. But salt is still one of the most common. How do we extend that metaphor here? As the salt of the earth, as disciples are the salt of the earth, how are they acting as a preservative? What are they preserving to start with? Right? If I rub salt in my meat, I'm trying to keep my meat from rotting and having it around throughout the seasons.
When you think preservatives are the idea of corruption, the idea of purity is singleness. So you add a particular item, you add the salt to it to make sure that the item stays just that particular item instead of introducing all the corruptive influences and leading to ruin.
I think it was at the very end of the lesson he described it rather bleakly. There in the conclusion, he says, the sinful world continues to exist because of the faithful disciples of Christ scattered across the rotting landscape. It's like, whew, it's pretty harsh. But that's part of his point. What's the point he makes here in this section about like Sodom and Gomorrah and stuff like that, and how the righteous were meant to be preservatives there? They weren't preservatives there because they weren't there. But there are several places in the Bible where he says that the reason that something is forestalled is because of the righteous. So in the discussion he had with Abraham about Sodom and Gomorrah, Abraham's like, well, what if there are 50 righteous people there? And God's like, I would save it for 50 righteous people. Well, how many people were there total? How many people lived in Sodom and Gomorrah at this time, right? And Abraham was going down through percentages. So you can just imagine, we'll use fake numbers because they're easier. Just say 500 people lived there. And Abraham said, well, what if there are 50 righteous? So what if just 10% is righteous? And then he kept lowering it, right? And lowering it. What if they're just, 10, 5, you're down to 1%. What if just 1% are righteous? And I don't know how many people live there. Nobody does. But you can imagine something like that being like 1%. And God's like, I will save it for 1%. He couldn't find 1%. And they were both destroyed. And there are other passages in the Bible with the same idea, that this will not be destroyed because of the righteousness. The other examples he gives here is like during the days of Josiah. So something they talked about in the, is it 2 Kings? I guess it was 2 Kings. When Israel was being taken off into Assyrian captivity, it was on the table that Judah would also be taken off into Assyrian captivity. And it was only because of this remnant of righteousness in Judah that said, all right, you're not being taken into captivity yet. And of course that degraded and they got taken into Babylonian captivity. But that's what God's looking for. God's looking for that bit of righteousness that is still there. And the point that the author of this lesson is making is that that is part of what is forestalling the end of times. Because God is long-suffering, not wishing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. But at some point, there's not going to be enough righteousness. There's not going to be the 10, the 5, you know, the 1%, whatever it is, whatever that threshold is, and it's going to be all over. And of course, the other aspect of preservation is that we are preserving the gospel. We are keeping to the pure gospel, keeping the gospel pure, and spreading the gospel. Salt gives flavor. Okay, so what's the flavor of a Christian? What's the flavor of a disciple? How do we extend that metaphor? Because we talked before about if salt loses its flavor. Maybe we should approach it from that way. What does it mean about a Christian if they've lost their flavor? How does that exhibit itself? You're looking at somebody and it's like, well, this Christian has lost their flavor. Yeah, so you are no longer that thing that is distinct. So you can imagine, I've had this happen before, somebody hands me a salt shaker and I go shaking salt on it and I taste the food and it doesn't taste any saltier. What in the world happened? So I shake even more on it and I taste it. It doesn't taste any saltier. Then I just shake some salt in my hand and I lick the salt and the salt doesn't even taste salty. I don't know if y'all have ever run across that. It said if salt loses its flavor, whatever. I've actually run across salt that lost its flavor. It's like, well, what in the world is going on here? Jesus is our ultimate example of salt, our ultimate example of light. You could see the influence he had wherever he went. You could see that as he went somewhere, people took on his flavor. People became more like him because they were exposed to him. That's what they're looking for us. By they, I mean God the Father, the Holy Spirit, and Jesus. That's what they're looking for us. That as we go out there and we're Christ-like and we imitate Christ and they can glorify God through us and they can see Christ through us, that as we are Christ-like and people are exposed to that flavor, that they take on that Christ-likeness. If you're going around through your life and people aren't becoming more like Christ because they're around you, then you have to question if you have your flavor. You have to question if you're having that influence that's going to happen. And that influence permeates. They use yeast as an example in another spot, but with salt, you don't like sprinkle some salt on the top of your soup, and then you take a bite of soup, and then you get down deeper in the soup, and it's not salty anymore. It doesn't work like that. The saltiness permeates the food. Our influence should permeate around us. Salt creates thirst. Salt creates thirst. How does that work? How does us being Christians create a desire in other people? What are they desiring? They see you, you're a Christian, you're the salt, you're the light. And they want that. Why do they want it?
I can say as a young person, when I was being, I think, greatly influenced, there were two specific preachers that started working with our congregation on two different occasions that really had a big influence on me as wanting to immerse myself more into the gospel and become a preacher and that kind of thing. So the idea of someone's influence, you can see it in them. There's something that they're doing that touches you as being special or important or different that you're curious about and interested in that you want for yourself. And so it leads you to thing to strive to be the same. And we do that with the world, certainly.
I think in that case, I think about the contagiousness of enthusiasm, where if somebody's fired up about something, they draw people to them. And you'll see that happen. Whatever, that just happens organically with us as people. Like, you can see that happen just like at Buffalo Wild Wings. You just have a bunch of people there at Buffalo Wild Wings and they're eating or whatever in the world. But they got games on. And if they have the Cowboys game, and if you have a section of Buffalo Wild Wings and people are getting all excited about whatever's happening in the game, you'll see other people that are in the room that are interested in the Cowboys and excited about the Cowboys start gravitating to that side of the room. And all of a sudden, that whole side of the room is just all in on the Cowboys thing, and they've gotten louder and cacophonous and such. And you got other people who are like, "You crazy people, I'm just here to eat wings," and they're off elsewhere. It describes people that come to God as having a love for the truth. In my example, we've got people with a love for the Cowboys, right? People that have that innate love for the truth, when they see other people fired up about a love for the truth, they're going to gravitate towards them, and they're going to amplify one another. And they're going to be stronger as a result of it. It's one of those examples they use of... I think it was like a candle and a match or something like that. But the idea was that you took a match and you lit a candle, and now you've got two flames. But if you put the match back by the candle, the flame from them next to each other was more light than the two of them separate, because they support one another, they build upon one another. I think another thing is happiness. It should be happiness. That if people see us and they see us happy in situations that most people wouldn't be happy, or they see us unfazed by things that are of this world, and they look at that and they're like, "Well, I want some of that. Why aren't you sad right now? Why aren't you impacted by this thing like we just were?" It's interesting. I've described before that one of the ways that we can be salt or light is by people seeing us face adversity. And so somebody asks you about how you face the death of a family member, or somebody asks you how you face being fired from a job or something like that, and you know, you've got the "what would Jesus do?" And you think, you know, you see people get fired and they're screaming and yelling and throwing things as they leave or something like that. And it's like, well, that's not how Jesus would behave in that way. But the way that Jesus behaved, the way that he even behaved when he was, you know, coming up on trial or after he'd been beaten and stuff like that, you had people that weren't interested in being good at all that were taking notice of it. This was light. This was salt. This was something that, you know, you should take notice of. And then the people that love the truth, they're going to be like, "Well, I want some of that. I want some of that peace. I want some of that clarity. I want some of that happiness. I want some of that ability to have joy in situations that don't seem like they should be joyous." Let's turn over to John. Let's have two people read. One person from John chapter 1 and one person from John chapter 3. John chapter 1, verses 1 through 9.
Thank you.
Yeah. And someone else, John 3, 19 through 21. So he was the true light, the light of the world. The darkness did not understand it. The light came into the world. The men loved the darkness rather than the light. What is the darkness? What is darkness? The absence of light. Darkness isn't anything. It's kind of like, what is cold? Cold is the absence of heat. It's the same kind of thing. And when we think about those relativities, right, it's not something that we naturally do as humans. You know, if you say, I'm trying to think of an example that is both accurate and not inflammatory. If you say, what's better, murder or assault? Like, neither one of those are better. They're both awful. What are you talking about? But everything is relative. Everything is relative when you talk about the temperatures or the light. You know, what's brighter? One candle or two candles? Well, two candles aren't very bright, but two candles are clearly brighter than one candle. The space next to Pluto is clearly warmer than the space outside of the magnetosphere of the sun. Both of those are a 100 degrees below zero. We don't think of them as warm, but it's all relative. So darkness is the absence of light. Sometimes we'll talk about caves as kind of our place to get the most darkness. You ever gone on one of those cave tours and you're way underground and they've got all this artificial light and stuff in there so you can see all the stalactites and the stalagmites, but then they'll be like, all right, we're going to turn the lights off for a second. And they go and do it. And it's black. It is black. Like, you can't see anything, can't see your hand in front of your face. It's black. It's the absence of light. And then we use the example of, well, what if you have just one candle then? Then that seems pretty bright compared to absolute darkness. And then in our metaphor, you get to the full extent of heaven where God is the light and it's just brightness, encompassing brightness. I saw a video one time and they were showing heaven and it was very white and it was very bright. But one thing they had gone back and done in the video was they had made sure that there were no shadows. Because the light was enveloping. It was all around you all the time. There wasn't an idea like, this light's brighter and I've got my shadow back here on the wall. Because God's brightness encompassed everything. There were no shadows at all. But then people are drawn to the light. Why are they drawn to the light? If you are sitting there in a cave in complete blackness, and someone manages to get their flint or whatever going, and they manage to light their lantern or whatever, why are people then drawn to that light? I think it gets into some of what it's saying here in the first point, that it reveals and illuminates. I'm not calling to mind the passage now, but it talks about having light with you so that you don't stumble. And there's a sense of security that also comes with the light, because if you're walking through the woods and you can't see at all, and now you've got some light, it's at least illuminating your path a little bit and you can try to make better decisions. Now people get a little bit of a false sense of security there. They think they know more about what's going on than not, and it turns out that just outside that cone of light You've got the mountain lions or whatever else that are keeping a good eye on you, on what's going on. But you've got that light, and you've got some security in that light because of the second point, that it drives away the darkness. So, what does it mean that the darkness didn't comprehend the light? They're completely incompatible. You can't be like, you know, hey, bring that flashlight over here. I want to see this darkness a little better. Like, that doesn't make sense. Once you bring the flashlight, the darkness is gone. They're incompatible. And the things in the dark often will react negatively to the light, right? A classic example is you turn on the light and a bunch of bugs scatter. Like, oh, we don't like this. We thought we were under cover of darkness. Well, why do bugs want to be under cover of darkness? Why do they care? Why don't they just, you turn on the light and they just still hang out? Why do they all run away?
Afraid of exposure.
Yeah, they're afraid of exposure. They're afraid of the vulnerability that's come upon them because the light's shone. We have that problem. We as humans have that problem, and so we in the church also have that problem. Some people don't like the light to shine on them because it makes you vulnerable. It exposes you. Why would you not want to be exposed? Why as a human would you not want to be exposed by the light of the gospel? You're ashamed about what people are going to see, or even what you're going to see. A lot of times that you don't want to admit things about yourself, and that if you actually use the light of the Word and the light of Christ to expose and reveal something about yourself. It's not a rational way to think. We talk about that with people who are afraid to go to the doctor and get a test for cancer. Like the test is going to give them cancer. Right? But they're still afraid to do it. They don't want to do it. They don't want to find that thing out about themselves. It's true whether they know it or not, but they don't want to find it out about themselves. And that happens with sin in our lives. That happens with hypocrisy in our lives. Passage there we read second said they don't want their deeds to be exposed. Why would that be? Why are there people who the light shines on them, it shows they're living evilly, and so they move away from the light. They want to stay in the darkness. Why would they do that? They like what they're doing. Why do they like what they're doing? Yeah, oh, I'm asking anybody. I'm looking at you because you talked last. There are no answering rules. Anyone's allowed to answer any question or talk at any time.
That's part of the appeal of Satan, is that he gives us allurements and enticements that maybe the end is that, but the interim is enjoyable. To those dark works and dark actions. And so they want to stay in it. And they don't want someone to tell them wrong or to reveal them wrong. They kind of want to stay in it, but they enjoy it.
kind of gets back to what we talked about last time on being strangers and pilgrims, about your delayed gratification, you know, and you've got things now, but the things way out in the future aren't as real to you. You'd rather have what you have now. You think back to the cave. If you've ever been in a cave and it's been just flat out black and your flashlight goes out, and you generally know the path you took into the cave, so you generally can follow the path back out. That moment that you first can see some light, and like the first light you see in that cave, it's reflected like two or three corners up the way. But that first time you see just a bit of light, you're seeing your salvation. I'm going to actually get out of this cave. If I continue walking towards the light, there's going to be more illumination. I'm going to be able to better see what I'm doing. I have a goal out there in mind. The light that we show, the light that we reflect of Christ, is showing that ultimate goodness at the end. But there are people that look at that and they say, that's a false goodness, or I'd rather have what I have now, or you don't know what's up ahead. There could be a chasm up ahead. You're going to kill yourself trying to get to that light. I'm going to stay here in the dark. I'll tell you, I had problems with this lesson. I kept having to extend the metaphors further and further. I couldn't figure out how to talk for an hour on salt and light. We're pretty familiar with them. Light warms and comforts. He's extending the metaphor even further. How do we warm and comfort each other with our light? That we bolster one another. We remind one another of what's important. We help refocus one another. You know, being here with fellow Christians, talking about heaven, talking about hell, remembering the Lord's death together, it can help keep your path straight. It can help keep you on the illuminated path, not falling into the darkness of worry, not falling into the misstep of having your focus over here and you're not heading towards God, the ultimate light source. Helps us to remember what's important. Helps us to shine a light on aspects of ourself that maybe have gotten a little darker because we weren't paying too close attention. Then we got other people that are on the same path, other people that are reflections of the light of Christ. Helps us to see more clearly.
Justin, one point that you made just a moment ago, I would like to just enlarge on for a second. This concept that you said, he extended the metaphor. It's true, and I like Heath a lot. I do want to emphasize this, that when Jesus gave these statements concerning salt and light, his intent was that concept of influence in illuminating or in flavoring, so that we'll see God. God's glory. And so the idea of warming and comforting, though you can make the point, that's not what Jesus is saying. Sometimes I think we kind of strain a little bit to get more out of the passage. There's no need for that because these other verses and such indicate that same thing. But that's really not intended by Jesus' teaching there. God's light warms and comforts. It's a good thing. It's because it reveals is the whole point of that.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Heard a sermon one time, and man, they were really extending the metaphor because they were talking about if you're in the light of Christ, it's like being in the light of the sun, and the sun gives you vitamin D, and then the vitamin D of Christ is. I'm like, oh, you're breaking my brain. Why are you trying to go that far with it? Well, even in this passage, at one point he says, you know, that our speech is supposed to be seasoned with salt. I'm like, that has nothing to do with what Jesus was talking about. We're supposed to be the influence. Where our speech is supposed to be seasoned with ourselves? Like, no, that doesn't work. But we're trying to get these overall concepts of influence. That really is where the focus needs to be here. And this last section here is talking about maintaining our influence. First of all, why is it important for us to have this influence? Let's talk particularly about us as related to the world. Why is it important for us to have this influence?
In the end, to glorify God.
Yeah, so God gets the glory. What happens if we don't have the influence? Yeah, we aren't impactful. We aren't producing the outcome that God would have us to have. I mean, who's the one casting the flavorless salt into the road? It's the one that's trying to use the salt. Who's trying to use the salt? God. God's trying to use the salt. Over in Titus, it's talking about elders. Says, for this reason I left you, he's talking to Titus, this reason I left Titus in Crete, that you would set in order what remains and appoint elders in every city as I directed you, namely, if any man is above reproach, so that's talking about their relationship to others, the husband of one wife, having children who believe, not accused of dissipation or rebellion. For the overseer must be above reproach as God's steward, not self-willed, not quick-tempered, not addicted to wine, not pugnacious, not fond of sordid gain, but hospitable, loving what is good, sensible, just, devout, self-controlled, holding fast the faithful word which is in accordance with the teaching, so that he will be able to both exhort in sound doctrine and to refute those who contradict. So you're looking at the elders here, and it's like, we've got this goal. The goal is for them to be overseers. Okay, but what are they doing as overseers? Well, they're shepherding the flock. They're exhorting people in sound doctrine. They're refuting those who contradict that might corrupt the church. But if they don't have these things up above, if they're not a man above reproach, then they're not going to have that influence. People are going to look at them and be like, well, why should I listen to you? Or why should I follow you? You're not proven trustworthy. You're not proven to be... he talks in here about being a hypocrite. You can imagine if an elder was a hypocrite, just an open, obvious hypocrite, the sheep aren't going to follow. Their influence is corrupted. Their salt doesn't have flavor. Their light isn't brilliant. It isn't illuminating. Talking more about the elders over in 1 Timothy 3 and verse 7, He goes through all the qualifications again, but at the end he says, and he must have a good reputation with those outside the church so that he will not fall into reproach and the snare of the devil. These are definite dangers. If you go and you are not behaving as you should, if you're not being that light you should be, if you're not being that pure reflection, you're being a corrupted reflection of the light of Christ, people are going to see that. People look, I'm trying to remember, I think it's off on one of these next pages. Was it Philippians? I think it was Philippians. No, that was another part of it. I'm thinking about the part where it says that people are going to see your behavior and they're going to blaspheme God. And what it's talking about in that passage is that they're going to see your hypocrisy and they're going to say, this Christian thing, it's got no value. They go and they say and do these things that contradict what they're saying. I don't want to be a part of that. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to follow a God like that or a Christ like that. I'm uninterested in that thing because they recognize that there isn't a purity there. They recognize that that's bad salt. They recognize that that's bad light. And because they see that in us, they don't look on to the pure and good light of Christ, the pure and good salt of Christ. We have to be pure and good in all things. Heard a sermon one time and he was talking about headlights, and on the back of every box of headlights it says you should change both headlights at once. And the reason is that headlights dim over time. The older ones anyhow, I don't know, LEDs and all that now, but the older headlights dim over time. And so if you have a headlight go out and you replace a headlight and your other headlight's like 6 years old or something like that, then this one's going to be a lot brighter than that one. And we're back to the people follow the light. Aren't that different than moths? People follow the light. If you just have, if you just go in and give somebody a car and give them two headlights and one's brighter than the other one, they will tend to drift towards that brighter headlight while they're driving. They'll notice the line and they'll get back off it and things like that. But that's the natural instinct. That's why cops always have this problem that drunk drivers run into the back of their vehicles, because the drunk drivers are drawn to the light naturally. That's why Christ used the metaphor, because we are naturally made that way. All of Christ's metaphors, he's explaining something that's true about our physical nature, and he's making a spiritual application of that. I think it was... I want to find that passage, though, because I hate when I don't have the passage. It may have been the one over in Romans. Yeah, that was it. Romans 2, starting in verse 21. You therefore who teach another, do you not teach yourself? You who preach that you shouldn't steal, do you steal? You who say you shouldn't commit adultery, do you commit adultery? You who abhor idols, do you rob temples? You who boast in the law through the breaking of the law, do you dishonor God? For the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you, just as it's written. So that was the point that Paul was trying to make there, is that if you behave in this way contrary to the gospel, it's going to be immediately evident. Immediately evident. You know, I always worry I'm not going to have enough to say, and then I always blabber on for the entire hour. So there you go. Next time we're going to be talking about the disciple's answer, the way in which a disciple is an apologist. Thank you all.